Welcome to the Reason Podcast. I'm Todd Cranin. Does defensive gun use stop crime? Would more gun control save lives? Those were the topics of a public debate recently hosted by the Soho Forum, Reason's debate series held at the Subculture Theater in New York City's East Village. Today's debate pits Gary Kleck, a criminologist from Florida State University, against Paul Helmke, the former president of the Brady Campaign and the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, as well as the former mayor of Fort Wayne, Indiana. The debate was held on September 13, 2018. Soho Forum director Gene Epstein moderated.
I'm Gene Epstein, director of the Soho Forum, and tonight's resolution reads, our first compound sentence for a resolution, not too complicated to follow, I believe. While laws that restrict gun ownership would reduce crimes perpetrated by criminals, comma, that benefit would be more than offset by the foregone opportunities for defensive gun use by victims of crime. And now, Gary, you are there to defend the resolution about guns. Please come to the podium and defend the resolution.
Thank you, Gene. And I'm happy the voting was done before you got a chance to get a good look at me. All right, the proposition really has 2 points. And I only want to make 2 points. Number one, if you actually banned guns, it's going to primarily affect non-criminals. And that's the non-controversial part of what I'll have to say. And secondly, there's a harm in taking guns away from good guys, which is where the controversy enters in. First of all, let's define what we mean by a prohibitionist gun control law. By definition, it means you're trying to take guns away from everybody. Theoretically, legally speaking, it applies to everyone equally, criminals and non-criminals alike. But in practice, that's not going to be the case. The NRA may have been a little over the top when they said when guns are outlawed, only outlaws will have guns. But you know, a more moderate way of phrasing the same basic idea is if you tell everybody they can't have guns, the people likeliest to obey the law that says you can't have guns are the law-abiding. I mean, it's true by definition. It's not really a controversial point. So what that implies is you will proportionally reduce the share of non-criminals who have guns, whose only involvement in crime would be as victims, than it would be the proportional drop in gun ownership among criminals. It's just because the compliance with the law will be higher among non-criminals than criminals. Well, that in turn means that gun uses by non-criminals will be affected more. So you'll reduce defensive uses of guns by non-criminal victims more than you'll reduce criminal uses by offenders, just because of who it is that would obey the law. So if you're really pro-control and you favor banning guns, you don't really care about taking guns away from non-criminals. You figure, well, you know, at worst, maybe a few hunters won't be able to shoot Bambi. So big deal. There's no serious harm until you take account of self-defense with a gun. And for years, the myth was, well, you know, it's crazy to try to defend yourself with a gun because the criminal will only take it away and use it against you. It's completely mythical. You know, when pressed for examples of that happening, advocates of gun prohibition came up empty. It just doesn't happen. And I systematically looked into it using the National Crime Victimization Survey data, which is a huge-scale national survey done by the Census Bureau that asks people about their crime victimization experiences. And nobody has that experience. People who use guns for self-protection have, you know, basically one result. They come out of it okay. The bad guy doesn't take their gun away from them, and they don't get injured or lose property. So where did this notion that self-defense with a gun is a bad thing come about? You know, people would be able to cite examples where somebody used a gun defensively and was injured, only here's the little detail they left out. They got injured first and then out of desperation used the gun for self-protection. Well, it can hardly be use of the gun that caused them to get hurt, because they got hurt first. And for a long time, the survey in question didn't get at that detail of sequence. It turns out virtually nobody who uses a gun for self-protection is then subsequently hurt. Likewise, virtually nobody loses property. In short, self-defense with a gun is almost perfectly effective, and relative to other forms of self-protection, it's more effective. That is to say, anything else you could do, running away, yelling for help, fighting without a weapon, calling the cops, you name it, anything else, or doing nothing, it doesn't work as well as using a gun for self-protection. And by using it, I mean it's usually just threatening with a gun. It rarely involves shooting, and when it involves shooting, often it's just shooting up in the air. It's a warning shot. And it hardly ever involves good guy shooting and wounding bad guy. So it's basically threatening a criminal with a gun is almost always effective. Now, the evidence for this is overwhelming. There's really no serious dispute about that. Where big dispute came about was, how often does this happen? Okay, maybe it's effective, but who cares? It practically never happens. You know, crime victims will almost never have the chance to use a gun for self-protection. And in a place like New York City, that's true. If you're not carrying a gun, if you don't have a gun, you can't use a gun for any purpose. But in the rest of the world, or the rest of the United States anyway, people are armed to the teeth. It used to be a point of propaganda that we had way too many guns and there were more guns than people, and it wasn't true 30, 40 years ago. It's true now. There's over 350 million guns in private hands now. And the big boost was the Obama effect. You know, Barack Obama would make noises about various kind of gun control measures, and everybody raced out and bought whatever kind of gun they didn't already own. So, and he'd make jokes about it. You know, he'd say I was the biggest friend of the gun industry they ever had. Well, what we know about how often defensive gun use occurs in the country as a whole is, again, the National Crime Victimization Survey. Well, the problem with that, though, is it's a non-anonymous survey done by the federal government. So somebody who works for the government and who is reporting to the Justice Department, that is the law enforcement branch of the federal government, is asking the questions in a non-anonymous survey. Not surprisingly, this does tend to discourage people from reporting a defensive gun use. So we unfortunately have to use other sources of information, and there have now been over 20 national surveys that have asked the question, have you used a gun for self-protection? And they use representative probability samples of the population so that you can project to the population as a whole how many defensive gun uses there were. The estimates range from 1 to 3 million. Huge numbers. And to put that in perspective, most years there are fewer than 500,000 crimes in which the offender used a gun. So there's on the order of 4 times as many defensive gun uses by victims as there are criminal uses by offenders. So now combine that with original premise I started with, which is, if you ban guns for everybody, in theory, the way it works out in practice is you'll reduce defensive gun uses proportionally, defensive gun uses by non-criminals, more than you'll reduce criminal uses by crime offenders. And so you've got guns that are used for self-protection huge numbers of times and that are used very, very effectively to reduce injury. If you get rid of all that defensive gun use, the implication is those people who would have used a gun but now can't are more likely to be injured. You would therefore have more injuries, mostly non-fatal, but some fatal, as a result of denying guns to people who could have used them effectively for self-protection. So I'll reserve the rest of my time to Paul. He'll need it.
Paul, There's no trading. You can't pay for the minutes. You do get 15.
Okay.
Gary took less than 10. You can take your 15 if you want.
Well, first of all, just thank you all for being here. Thank you for the invitation. It's been 10 years since I debated Gary. We had a 3-on-3 debate where I debated Gary, John Lott, and Steve Halbrook, from a lawyer for the NRA. This is my second time with Gene in one of his debates. I debated John Lott 2.5 years ago, I think it was, at your former venue, and always enjoy having the chance to discuss this issue. I come to this issue from multiple backgrounds. I was a lawyer in Fort Wayne, Indiana for years. I was a mayor in Fort Wayne, Indiana. I run the police department. I dealt with the issue of crime and defensive gun uses and criminal gun uses quite a bit as head of the police department. After I left the mayor's office, I later took a job as head of the Brady campaign and the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, where we tried to lobby for some common sense, what I considered common sense gun laws. And now I'm a professor at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. I don't do research. I look at things more from a law and a policy side. Gary does all these research and statistics and regression theories that go over my head, but I'm always happy to debate these sorts of issues. This issue is a complicated issue. It's a complicated proposition. Gary's treating it as sort of prohibitionist, and one of the versions of the resolution was prohibitionism. I think the final one that Gene announced was, while laws that restrict, not prohibit, gun ownership would reduce crimes, the benefit would be more than offset by the defense of gun uses. We'll forget the proposition. I think the main issue here is, are guns more of a benefit, or are there more costs that come from guns? Is our system one that puts more costs or more benefits on us? And our present system doesn't prohibit guns. I don't know anyone who really argues for a prohibition of guns. With 350 million guns out there, it's considered a lost cause, even if someone would want to. But Gary talked a lot about what he saw as some of the benefits of having guns. When we talk, and guns can be used defensively, guns can be a benefit. But clearly there are costs with guns. And I think before we get into the issue of how many defensive gun uses there are and doing the cost-benefit analysis, let's just briefly review the costs that go along with guns. In this country today, basically we have 2 to 3 accidental deaths by a gun every day. 2 to 3 people are killed with a gun accidentally every day, oftentimes young children. There are the stories you read, the 5-year-old finds the gun and kills the 3-year-old sister. There's the teenager that didn't know the gun was loaded. That's one of the reasons I came to this issue. I had a friend that was shot in the back when other friends thought the gun wasn't loaded. 2 to 3 accidental gun deaths per day in this country. And I might mention that's quite a few. That's a lot more than other countries experience in terms of accidental gun deaths. Every day there's also 55 suicides by gun. Now, a lot of people say, what's that got to do with this whole issue? We're not talking, they're not criminals. That's not accidental. What suicides are going to happen regardless. We have more suicides by guns than any other country. And one of the things, when you talk to people that deal with mental health issues, that deal with suicide prevention, is that if someone's thinking that they want to commit suicide, and then there's a lot of discussion about this is really a cry for help. You want some intervention. It's a spur of the moment type thing. It's different, obviously, in different situations. Basically, almost every other way that you try to commit suicide, your success rate might be 10% to 20%. If you use a gun, it's 90% to 95%. So we end up with 55 suicides per day in this country. Then we have homicides. We average about 32 gun homicides per day in this country. That's a Virginia Tech happening every day in this country. And nobody pays too much attention to it unless it's in the mass shooting. So those 90 to 100 type deaths are happening with the gun every day in this country. Those are the costs of our current gun policy. And for every death with a gun, there's another 2 to 3 people that are injured with that gun and survive. They survive the accidental shooting or the homicide attempt or the suicide attempt, and they live with that gun injury oftentimes the rest of their life. These are the people like Jim Brady, who was killed, who was injured, seriously injured in the in the assassination attempt on President Reagan. He late died just a couple years ago. They attributed his death actually to that shooting, but he lived with that every day of his life for 30 plus years. It's Gabby Giffords who got that bullet in her brain in Tucson in 2011, how that's affected her. And for every one of those gunshot victims, you've got the families who survive. You've got their families and their friends and their coworkers that are helping to bear the costs, that are seeing the pain, that they're seeing the suffering. You know, I still remember one of the last nights I spent with Jim Brady. I was at his house, and I could hear him scream every time he rolled over in the bed. And those were from injuries that had been happened 25 years earlier. There's continuing costs for all of us. Then there's the direct costs, the medical costs, the lost productivity. Estimates go from anywhere from $6 million for the direct costs, half of which are paid by the taxpayer. Some people go up to even $1 billion in costs in terms of the impact of gun violence in this country. Gun violence in this country gives us a very serious cost. Now, is this normal? You know, maybe this is just part of what life's like. No. Children under 15 are 9 times as likely to die of an accidental shooting in this country than in the rest of the developed world. That's children under 15, 9 times as likely to die of the accidental shooting here than in other civilized developed nations. In 1992, our murder rate was 5 times that of the other frontier, English frontier countries, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. Most of those murders were gun murders. 10 times the suicide rate by guns in this country than in the other 25 most developed countries. 10 times more suicide by guns. It's in every 17 times more gun homicides in this country than in the other civilized countries. Why does this country have so many more deaths, accidental deaths, suicide deaths, homicides by gun than the other countries? There's one reason. We have more guns per capita than anybody else does. When you look at these 350 million guns, that makes a difference. And it makes a difference when the studies, and I'm not the expert, I haven't done the research, but there are people that have published their studies that show that a gun in the home is 21 times more likely to be used against you and a family member than it is to protect you from an intruder. Often, a lot of that's the suicide, but sometimes it's the accidental shooting. Sometimes it's picking up the gun and shooting the brother-in-law when you don't expect him to come in the middle of the night. 21 times more likely to be used against you or a family member than it is to protect you. There's been some studies that show those who carry a gun are 4 times more likely to get shot than those who don't carry. Now, these aren't necessarily causation things. That's what's so tricky in this thing. People that have the gun in their home might be in more dangerous neighborhoods. People that carry the gun might be in more dangerous professions. Women have a risk of being a domestic homicide victim. Their risk of being a domestic homicide victim increases 7 times if there's a gun in their home. Guns make things more dangerous. And there are a lot of studies out there that basically say that the more guns you have in a house, in a county, in a state, in a country, the more gun violence you're going to have. That includes all the homicides, the suicides, and the accidental shootings. There are tremendous costs to having gun violence, to our gun policy, tremendous costs of gun violence in our country. And that's something that needs to be taken into account. One thing I learned as mayor, when you look at crime statistics, too, is that there's a lot of variation. You've got different reports, different ways of looking at things. One of the hardest numbers to fudge are deaths. And so when you look at those numbers of deaths, you've gotten something significant. Okay, so there's cost, serious cost to our current gun policy. Now, Gary argues that there are benefits, though, to having guns. And sure, sometimes a good guy with a gun stops the bad guy with a gun. Sometimes Jason Bourne, James Bond, John Wayne, whoever it is there to stop the bad guy. But the statistics are all over the place. Gary's initial study on this said that there were about 2.4 defensive gun uses each year in this country. There's a group called the Gun Violence Archive that looks at, like, every newspaper, every police report they can find on a daily basis. Obviously, not everything gets reported. They came up with 2,100 defensive gun uses in all of 2017. just a little over 2,000. That's the bottom line probably. But that's looking at police reports. That's looking at newspaper studies across the country to try to find some evidence that there have been defensive gun uses. The National Crime Victimization Study that goes back to people twice a year, that follows up with information, they come up with 100,000 defensive gun uses each year. Gary comes up with 2.4 million. Where did this number come from? Again, I'm not the expert. There's all sorts of arguments about false positives and how people are unwilling to, we'll say that they've done a defensive gun use when they really haven't. Gary argues that there's also false negatives. But, you get those, if you want those debates, there's tons of scholars that do this. I've noticed when you read scholarly literature, they're actually nastier than politicians. It's amazing. It's a, they keep writing. There's concerns with rare events. When you're looking about something that happens only 1% or 2% of the time, obviously it doesn't take too many people reporting falsely or remembering things poorly to get the number up higher. There's the problem with telescoping. Yes, I used the gun, but maybe it was 3 years ago and you're only asking about the last 2 years. The National Crime Victimization Study tries to correct for those things by going back to the same people and following up with the same questions. There's questions of sampling. Gary's original sampling, which had 5,000 people on it, I read the whole thing the other night, talks about how it oversampled for males and people in the South and the West just because they knew they needed to do, he knew he needed to do that in order to get more people in the survey. Then he adjusts for it with a number, but if you adjust the if you make the adjustment wrong, then that can throw the numbers up. I don't know all those things. Gary can answer those and argue those better. There's other scholars that can do it, but the numbers vary. That's what I'm trying to point out. When I make policy as a mayor, I say, what are the numbers? And somebody says it's 2,000, somebody says it's 100,000, Gary says it's 2.4 million. Try to explain to me why there's so much discrepancy here. Gary's study's interesting, though, with some of the things they come up with, and it makes me wonder about the studies. Not only are there issues about these defensive gun uses not showing up in police reports, these defensive gun uses don't show up in hospital reports. They don't show up in emergency room reports. Gary says bad guys, when they're shot, don't go to the hospital. So maybe that takes care of it. But there's other things there. According to Gary's studies, when someone is confronted by a bad guy and they fire at them, they hit their target 53% of the time. It's a 53% hit rate in Gary's original study, which is something that police officers don't met, that's something that's unheard of. I mean, you're in a shootout situation, the adrenaline's flowing, and they're hitting their target 53% of the time. Another interesting thing in Gary's thing is that 46% of defensive gun uses are by women. This is in the early 90s. Now, maybe that's true, but it doesn't fit with any of the rest of the literature. Women don't own guns at the same rate. Women don't fire guns at the same rate. Women aren't involved in the gun culture at the same rate. But 46% of Gary's defensive gun uses are women. But the most amazing thing is Gary's conclusion, based on his survey, that there have been 340,000 to 400,000 lives saved. People saved from murder by defensive gun uses in a single year. Now think of that. I've already pointed out when you have 32 homicides a day, maybe we're doing 15,000 to 20,000 homicides a year in this country, but Gary's good guys with the guns are saving almost 400,000 each year. Something doesn't fit here. The numbers don't make sense to me. And I think that's one of the problems with this whole discussion. Last point I want to make, though, is even if Gary's numbers are right, or if they're somewhere in this range between the 100,000 and on the National Crime Study and Gary's study, are these necessarily beneficial, positive gun uses? This is the other fascinating thing. What are some of the categories that are considered defensive gun uses? Gary's original study counts saying, I've got a gun, is a defensive gun use. In other words, I've got a gun. Don't yell at me. Okay, defensive gun use. Only one half of those people that had a defensive gun use even pointed the gun at the offender. 47% said that there was no threat or attack for their defensive gun use. Excuse me, if there's no threat and there's no attack, how is it a defensive gun use? And you're not pointing your gun. It's a defensive gun use. 52% of the offenders, 52% of the bad guys were unarmed. And according to the survey, only 18% of the offenders had guns. Something's wrong here. You know, there's a lot of arguments over whether these defensive gun uses are effective. Some studies show that you're just as likely to get injured with a gun, without a gun. Some people say you're just as likely to get injured if you got a baseball bat, or even in better shape if you got a gun. Obviously, the numbers don't add up. What does add up is we've got significant costs, and the defensive uses are questionable. I think we can find a way basically to say, let's reduce the bad things from happening without taking the good things away. Thank you.
Gary Rebuttal, you can get up at the podium if you want. For the rebuttal, I recommend that.
No,
okay. Sean?
First of all, we need to make clear that the term prohibitionist covers a lot of ground. No, of course, the Brady campaign, which Paul used to head, is not advocating a complete ban on all firearms. That would be pointless. I mean, it's a political impossibility. However, the organization has favored a ban on handguns. In fact, they did this openly until the 70s, and then they kind of did it covertly thereafter. For example, they filed an amicus curiae brief on behalf of Washington, D.C.'s handgun ban when it was challenged and ultimately ruled unconstitutional. They were saying, we need to preserve this handgun ban. If that's not favoring banning handguns, if that's not favoring handgun prohibition, I don't know what is. Well, that was ruled unconstitutional. You couldn't favor that anymore. So they now favor banning so-called assault weapons, which are not military weapons. They can fire like machine guns. They're just ordinary, wildly popular guns owned almost overwhelmingly by non-criminals and used for non-criminal purposes that fire one shot at a time. And they favor banning those. They also favor banning magazines that hold more than 10 rounds, again, which are not used by mass killers to boost the casualty count in mass shootings. They're used almost entirely by non-criminals for non-criminal purposes. Paul refers to the fatality rates for suicides being many times higher for attempts with guns than for other attempts, as if we ought to compare guns with the entire set of all other suicide methods, as if people would be as likely to substitute the least lethal methods of suicide if they couldn't get a gun and put the gun to their head and pull the trigger. That's implausible. They would instead favor whatever is the next most lethal method of killing themselves, which is hanging. Here's the little secret he didn't share with you. There's no significant difference between the fatality rates of attempts by hanging and attempts by shooting. They're both about 80% fatal. He says guns are 21 times more likely to be used against gun owners than they are against the criminal. That's not true, but it's a myth that will not die. The studies it was based on in similar ratios, they didn't count all defensive gun uses, or even most of them, or even more than a tiny fraction. They covered killings. How many times are civilians, are the law-abiding people killed? How many times are the gun owners killed? And how many criminals did they kill? As if the point of having a gun for self-protection is to pile up bodies on your doorstep. That's not the point. The point is to save lives, to prevent injury. And you can't count up the number of lives saved or injuries prevented. So that ratio has absolutely no relevance at all. It's basically a cost-benefit ratio in which you counted up the cost and didn't count up any of the benefit. The benefit is not in killing criminals. It's in avoiding being killed yourself, or injured yourself, or losing property yourself. He says more guns lead to more gun homicide. Well, yeah, duh, that's true. More gun homicides. You can't commit a gun homicide unless you have a gun. The issue is, do you kill more people when there's more guns? Is there a higher homicide rate overall? No, there is not. All of the best methodologically soundest research, without exception, finds places with higher gun ownership rates do not have higher total homicide rates. They also don't have higher total suicide rates. They just have a higher percentage of homicides and suicides involving guns. He seriously cites as evidence of how often defense of gun use occurs the number of newspaper accounts or news accounts compiled in the Gun Violence Archive, and it says there were 2,000. Yeah, there probably are 2,000 defensive gun uses where somebody was crazy enough to actually report it to the police, which in turn got reported to the local news media. But that has nothing to do with how many are committed overall. It has absolutely nothing to do with it, because you'd be crazy to either tell the police or the news media or anybody else you don't absolutely have to tell that you pulled a deadly weapon on another human being. No matter how justified you think it was and how justified it in fact was, reporting it can do absolutely no good for you. Thank you.
Is it easier to see if you stand or okay? The we're getting to a lot of topics here. There are a number of studies that show opposite of what Gary says, and these are from other academics. And Gary gets into long arguments in journals and magazine articles with these other academics who basically say that Gary's not right, that his methodology's not right, that actually, when you look at many of these studies, that there are more, not only do we have more homicides in this country and more gun homicides, generally they show that our homicide rates are so much larger because of the guns, that if you take the guns out of it, we're the same level of rapes, we're the same level of robberies, we're the same level of burglaries, but we are out of whack in terms of total homicides, and that is driven by the fact that we have such high rates of gun homicides, and that's driven by the fact that we have guns. So yes, if you don't have guns, you're not going to have as many gun homicides, but we are so much worse than the rest of the developed world because we have so many of these guns. And that holds true for the accidental deaths, that holds true for accidental gun deaths, that holds true for the gun suicides, that holds true for these other things. A lot of times in the suicides, again, people are looking for a cry for help. And maybe there's some methods like hanging that are close to guns, but most people don't go to that trouble. Most people are trying pills. Most people are trying knives. Those are the things that end up at the 10% at the 20% level. In terms of gun bans, again, when I was at Brady, we supported Washington, D.C. But whenever I was asked that, I was said, when I was mayor of Fort Wayne, would I have pushed for a gun ban? I said no. I don't think they're effective, but I said if the people of Washington, D.C. feel this is going to be effective, then they should make that decision. And they made that decision in the mid-1970s. They thought that maybe some of their surrounding states and communities would do the same thing. They didn't. It was easy to get from Virginia. It was easy to get from Maryland into D.C., so it was pretty ineffective. It actually did reduce the number of suicides in D.C. after it went into effect, and actually there's some evidence that it reduced the number of homicides in D.C. for a period of time. But I told people if they disagreed with it, they ought to run for mayor of D.C. or for city council in D.C. Instead, they decided to have the court intervene and have the court get involved in the study. By the time it came up to the city of McDonald versus the city of Chicago case, Brady took a neutral stance on that brief because we felt that the court's decision in Heller, the D.C. case, was one that the court wasn't going to say there's going to be one set of rules for D.C. and another set of rules for every other city in the country. That just didn't make sense to us. And we also wanted to make sure that the people really understood what the Heller decision did. And again, we're not arguing Second Amendment law here, but the D.C. court, the Supreme Court in the D.C. case, Justice Scalia made it very clear that the Second Amendment right, like other rights, is not unlimited, and that you could have restrictions on who gets guns, how guns are sold, how guns are carried, how guns are stored, and what kind of guns are going to be available to the people. That's Justice Scalia's decision. That's what Justice Scalia wrote. That same language was basically repeated by Justice Alito 2 years later in the McDonald case. So clearly, communities, states can put restrictions on guns. And I think that's the real issue here. What sort of things can we do to try to make it harder for dangerous people to get guns? Since the last time I've debated Gary, we've had shootings at Sandy Hook, shooting at Tucson with Gabby Giffords. We had the Pulse nightclub shooting. We had the Las Vegas shooting. We've had numerous church shootings. And what have we done as a country in reaction to that? Nothing. Nothing. We've passed no national legislation. A few executive orders that President Obama tried after Sandy Hook have been rescinded since that time. We've done nothing as a country, and we still have problems here. And I don't think that makes sense to me. There are things we can do. And Gary admits it in some of his articles. Background checks aren't going to stop people from having good defensive gun uses. Most of the – there are no – I don't think Gary showed any defensive gun uses with semi-automatic assault, you know, so-called assault rifles, the AR-15s. Those aren't used for defensive purposes. If we make it – if we have some background checks, if we have some restrictions on weapons, you know, the Gabby Giffords shooter was stopped when he was going to change his magazine clip, his if he'd had a smaller magazine clip, he would have might not have killed that little girl, might have shot less people. The Sandy Hook kids, some of them got away when he went to change his high-capacity magazine. Those sorts of things do make a difference. I think as a country, we should look at some common-sense restrictions that make it harder for dangerous people to get guns, that stress that there are risks and responsibilities as well as rights that go along with guns, and that are not going to take away the chance for people to have good defensive gun uses if they need it.
We're going to the Q&A section. There might be moderator's prerogative to ask a couple of questions, which I plan to do. But first, at any time, you can ask a question of each other. Do you, Gary or Paul, want to ask the other a question at this moment? Or you want to pass for the moment on that?
Sure. I'll ask a couple of questions.
Okay, go ahead.
Number one, as to the Brady campaign's attitude towards Washington's handgun ban, they did write an amicus curiae brief, but did that say absolutely nothing about whether or not the Brady campaign thought that this was an effective way of controlling violence? Is that your position now, that the brief did not advocate this would be a good idea from a standpoint of policy?
The brief addressed the legal issues, the Second Amendment issues, which is what legal briefs do. They don't discuss the policy implications of it. We indicated that we thought that the Second Amendment, because it had that prefatory clause that says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, language that somehow disappears from the NRA building and many of the Second Amendment discussions, because that it dealt with a collective right, somehow connected to a militia. That was the main argument in a legal brief. Policy arguments are made by city councils and mayors. And by Congress, we were discussing the legal issues in the brief. And then most of the briefs, I don't think on any side really went into the effectiveness. Justice Breyer in his dissent did try to look at an interest balancing thing, brought up a number of those things. And there are people that brought those issues up as to the amount of gun violence in our community. But the crucial issue in front of the court in Heller was not the policy decision. It was, what does the Second Amendment mean? I think the court got it wrong, but I think they've allowed for most of the common sense gun restrictions that most states want to do.
Okay, the second question was you say that somewhere in my article about how many defensive gun uses there were, that I said defensive gun use saved 400,000 lives.
Yeah.
Is this really something I said, or is this something you're kind of reading into it?
Well, I was reading it at 1230 at night, so it I've actually got the page number here. On page 177 of the article that was published in 1995 with Gertz in the Journal of Criminology, which I think is the first main one that had your survey, on page where did I get my when I write this at that late at night, it gets okay. Page 177, 15.7% of the respondents believed that they saved a life with their defensive gun use. And then you said that would calculate to 340,000 to 400,000 saved lives. And then you say it's impossible to know that this is true.
There you go.
Basically, you were saying you couldn't believe your own numbers. And then at the end of your article, what you did is you basically said, I can't believe my respondent. So I'm only going to believe. You said that if you, okay, you said, even if they're not telling the truth, if only 10% of them are telling the truth, that would translate to 40,000 saved lives, which is more than the number of gun deaths in a year, and that therefore defensive gun use has made sense. So you had a very long discussion on this on page 177.
Right, which included the follow-up remarks, which you've snipped out of the quote or paraphrase or whatever you want to call that.
Well, this is,
what people think. Yeah, it's just their perceptions. Yeah, I stressed, you can't know that they would have saved a life.
And they're
lost a life if they didn't use guns.
But your study
say is, that defensive gun use saved 400,000 lives. That's just something you made up.
Okay, but you say that there's 2.5 million defensive gun uses.
That's
it's
true.
Parroted by all sorts of politicians. They don't include the other thing too, that maybe these people don't really do anything with this, since half of the people don't aren't even saying that they've got a gun. They're
That's actually segues into the question I want to put to you, Gary, having to do with Paul's challenge. He said specifically, let's assume for the moment that your 2 million ballpark, 1 to 2 million estimate is true. Okay. But what is the nature of this defensive gun use? He then broke it down and said, it's not really what you and I would think of as defensive gun use. Can you address that challenge, right, Paul's?
No, in every single case, they did something with the gun. They, at minimum, threatened the offender. And in a few cases, really just a small percentage of the cases, maybe 1 in 7, they fired at the offender, trying to shoot the offender. And in maybe 7% of the cases, they claimed to have shot the offender, but unfortunately, we never established how they knew that. I mean, they didn't have a wounded person sitting on their living room floor necessarily, bleeding on the carpet. Mm. They were just, in many cases, just guessing. So what we knew is that at minimum, they threatened the offender with the gun. And it's not just saying, as a sort of point of information, I've got a gun. It's threatening the person. There is a difference. It's not a point of information. When you're pointing a gun at somebody who's trying to rob you or trying to attack you, it has a meaning due to its context. And its meaning is, this is a threat. I'm willing to shoot you if you don't stop trying to victimize.
What they think they were doing. Only half of them pointed the gun. You say in your survey that you count I've got a gun as being a defensive gun use without even showing it.
It's a verbal threat.
Okay.
If you're trying to say that they're not all dramatic they don't all involve, attempts to physically assault the other person, absolutely. I said that from the get-go.
Okay.
But you seem to think there's no value in people merely threatening an offender, and then it causes them to not attack them.
No, it's
there's
it's,
value it's, in
yeah,
it.
I concede there are good defensive gun uses. But when somehow your $2.4 to $2.5 million defensive gun uses has become locked into the consciousness of the gun rights arguments in this country— and it turns out that a lot of this is just macho, I've got a gun, get away. Or, even though only 18% of you have a gun, you better get out of there because maybe half of your respondents think they pointed the gun at the person. We're talking about something different. I mean, when I think about defensive gun use, I'm thinking about someone who's got a gun, shows the gun, maybe points the gun, not necessarily shoots the gun. Brandishing does count. But half of your people didn't even point the gun at the person. I think we're living in a bit of a dream world here. And again, we're only talking about 222 respondents that admitted that these were the defensive gun uses.
You do realize
that. So you're getting down to the 111 who said they pointed the gun. Then you're getting down to the 40 30 that actually, had an attack going on. We're talking about pretty small numbers here.
You do realize as a lawyer that if somebody verbally threatens another person with violence, that is an assault. And if it's a criminal assault when a bad guy does it for bad purposes, why is it in your mind it's magically translated into not a real threat? Not unless he actually points the gun, but verbally threatening to shoot somebody, that doesn't count in your mind.
No, clearly that's a threat, but I think we're mixing different things. And people have taken your 2.4 million figure and translated it into they need their AK-47 to be able to shoot back when the gang is invading their house, to all of a sudden I saw somebody trespassing, so I said, I've got a gun, get out of my backyard.
Paul, my question to you is, let's say it is a half a million to a million. Yep. Let's cut it down. Half a million to a million. Let's set it up 3/4 of a million of defensive gun uses that you, Paul Humphrey, would say is legitimately a defensive gun use. You seem to have said you don't rule that out.
No.
If you don't rule it out, if it's 3/4 of a million and it's reasonable defensive gun uses, isn't that very considerably weighing in the balance in your view, if you believed that number? Which you haven't.
Well, I'm approaching this issue as, yes, guns can be used for beneficial purposes, and Gary's outlined some of those. But also, guns can be used for very negative purposes, and I tried to outline those. And I'm not taking a prohibitionist approach. I'm saying, let's do more background checks. Let's get some of these things, like some of the semi-automatic assault rifles and the high-capacity magazines, and perhaps treat those closer to how we treat machine guns than how we treat hunting rifles.
Right. Let's prohibit them.
Let's go after gun trafficking and do some things that are going to make it harder for dangerous people to get guns and stress the risks and the responsibilities of gun ownership, and then maybe we end up ahead. But instead, we do nothing.
Before we open it up to questions, just the final question thrown to you, Gary. Is there any restriction, legal restriction on gun use that you support? Any at all?
Yeah. Since at least going back as far as the early 90s, so over a quarter of a century ago, I've advocated what today has become known as universal background checks.
Good.
I'm all in favor of keeping guns away from bad guys, precisely because that's not a prohibitionist measure. It's not like we're not going to let anybody, criminal or non-criminal, have a semi-automatic weapon because it kind of looks like a machine gun, when we know perfectly well what that means is mostly disarming non-criminals. But a background check, it only prevents guns from going in the hands of people who can't pass the background check, which is convicted criminals, people with a record of mental illness, and so on, alcoholics, drug addicts, and so forth. And so it's the non-prohibitionist character that makes it a good idea, because it will only reduce bad uses of guns and won't reduce the defensive.
And that's the main legislative priority that the Brady campaign's had over the last 10, 20, 25 years since the Brady bill was passed. And that's something that we can't get Congress to adopt. And we need more people like Gary Kluck and others to stand up and say that makes sense.
Questions from the audience now. Do we have anybody out there? It's a little dark. Please phrase your question as a question. Take it away.
Sure. Mr. Mayor, what kind of restrictions or regulations would you propose or you think would help with the suicides or the domestic situations types of shootings? And what kind of data is there that they would actually help decrease those numbers?
It's going to, obviously laws aren't going to take care of all the, or even close to these problems. It's more the gun culture and the idea that having a gun in your home is going to protect you all the time and not realizing that gun is going to cause problems. I've told the story before. When I was mayor, I get a call one night. One of my police officers is married to, he's my labor relations director at the time. He's married to another police officer. They keep a loaded handgun on their nightstand because it's a dangerous world out there and they're policing their train. They have a domestic quarrel. She's dead. That's what happens. It's guns just have a lot of bad consequences to them. One of the things, some people propose waiting periods that might get someone who's just got a quick, all is lost. I need to commit suicide and it'll stop there. So that might stop someone else. I think a lot of it just deals with let's stress the responsibilities. Let's stress the risks that go with guns. Let's realize that these can be misused. Instead, we've got an attitude in this country that anyone should pretty much have any gun, anytime, any place.
Comment from you, Gary, to the question? No? No comment, Gary? No. Okay. Yeah. Next question.
I did a quick search after your comment about the number of accidental gun shootings per day. And it turns out in 2016, there were about 37,000 accidental deaths resulting from automobiles. If I think I do the division right, that's about 100 a day. I'm not going to ask you why you don't advocate more common sense automobile regulation. What I want to ask you is, your use of anecdotes are tragic and heart-wrenching. Why do gun control advocates have to rely on data like that, much of which has been discredited by people like Gary, in order to make your argument? Why can't you look at the same data and make the same argument with valid, useful data?
Okay. Let me talk about cars just real quickly, just because it comes up all the time. We register cars, so we know who the owner is. We license the drivers and have tests on that. I think registration of guns and licensing of gun owners might make some sense. When we find out that that a driver is misusing alcohol or drugs, we take their license away from them. We test to see if they know what they're doing when they're driving a car. When we find out that cars are unsafe, we start requiring things like airbags and seat belts and get rid of the pintos that explode, the type things. We have done a lot to reduce car violence by looking at both the people that drive the car and the cars themselves. That's a good approach to take. That's a public health approach toward things. Guns, I'd like to take the same approach toward. Let's figure out a public health model and figuring out what we can do. Part of the problem is it's tough to find good research. For a long time, and maybe this is changing, for a long time, basically, Congress had riders on some bills that made it almost impossible, or at least conveyed the message that the CDC, the National Institute of Health, could not do the research. So people had to research on their own, and then the research becomes suspect. I'd like to see more research done on this, and if the data takes us someplace, let's do it. The one thing that is pretty clear is the number of deaths that are occurring. That's data that's incontrovertible. That's one of the most solid things. That's not based on survey. That's, you know, maybe they can fudge some numbers. That's what I'm relying on. I'm relying on the number of people that are killed with guns each day. And then you try to figure out, where did the gun come from? Are there things that could have been done? All of that is hard to research, by the way, too, because Congress has also made it hard to trace where guns come from. You can find out where a single gun comes from, but you can't get information on whether that gun store is sold on the other guns used in crimes. We make it almost impossible to get the data. We do that so that way you can't develop a policy prescription that deals with guns.
A comment, Gary, on that?
Well, Paul admits to an advocacy of registration, and there's a difference between registering cars and registering guns, and the difference is nobody's seriously advocating banning cars. I mean, maybe, you know, the really green people would think there's something to be said for that, but they're a pretty small minority. But there are lots of people who do support banning guns, and certainly about half will support banning semi-automatic guns that get labeled as assault weapons, and about a quarter will still support banning handguns, although the number is declining. So, people want to ban it. And what would you need administratively if you wanted to seize all the guns or all the handguns or all the assault weapons or all the large capacity magazines? Well, you would need a record of who has them. I mean, it'd be a law enforcement or governmental impossibility to basically know who owed you a gun and who should turn it in if you declare you have to turn in, let's say, an assault weapon, which is exactly what's happened. State of California said, turn in your assault weapons, whatever they were. And how would they know whether you had one and should be turning it in? Well, the only way the government can know that is if they have a record of it. And that's what registration is. It records who has specific guns. It doesn't have any crime control value. Every single study that's assessed the impact of registration laws on crime rates has found there's no effect of having a registration law on crime rates. So it's got no crime control rationale, but it's got plenty of rationale making banning some subset of guns administratively feasible.
First of all, the Supreme Court in the Heller case and the McDonald case made it clear that you can't ban guns. So, I mean, it's the night after the Heller case. I congratulated Wayne LaPierre. I said, okay, you got what you wanted. Then the Supreme Court said the remedy for Dick Heller was that he should have his get the license for his gun. Said, why don't we move forward then with a licensing or registration scheme? Oh, no, we can't do that. They still might try to take our guns away. It's unconstitutional now. Supreme Court's behind you on this sort of thing. And then I point out that the most avid gun rights folks I usually deal with all have concealed carry permits, which means the government has their name. with the list of concealed carry permits.
And they don't like that either.
But they've got it out there. And then I point out, in this day and age, when Facebook and Twitter and everybody else can figure out what kind of toothpaste you use, what kind of deodorant you use, what kind of magazines you get, where you bank, you can find out pretty much everything about everybody. You don't think someone can figure out who the likely gun owners are in the country. The idea that the gun registration is some bugaboo that the government's going to take your guns away, I think that's left over from centuries, from decades past.
We want to make a brief comment.
So as a lawyer, you think that that kind of information that's sort of floating around on the internet would be enough for a court to issue a search warrant to look for a gun?
They're not going to do that because you can't have gun bans constitutionally
I'm pretty sure a registration form by the government would be a pretty good basis for probable cause to make a search.
Next question.
Somewhat related to the registration question. But more generally, for the entire restriction question, what do you think the effectiveness of any of these laws are going to be in the face of 3D printed guns and CNC milled?
Question about printed guns. Seemingly everybody wants to ask you a question, Paul. But why don't you answer that question first, and then Paul, you can comment. Can you answer the question first, Gary?
Okay.
Just change your format, Paul. Okay. You can go.
I wish I knew more about it, but it's one of those things where, first of all, the cat's already out of the bag, or the horse is out of the corral, or whatever the euphemism is. The information won't die. It's on the internet. It's circulating. The plans are there. The programming to make your 3D printer crank out the weaponry is there. But does anybody really want one? I mean, that was my initial reaction when I first heard about somebody saying, "Well, you could 3D print a gun." Why would you want one? I mean, first of all, most 3D printers they crank out plastic. Do you really want a gun that's going to melt after firing two or three times? And especially, are you going to want one when there's 350 million real guns out there made out of steel and wood and plastic and all sorts of really durable stuff? Why would you need or want this? So I think, it's kind of gun anarchists out there who are pushing the idea of putting out these 3D manufactured guns. It's of symbolic significance. I guess to a libertarian audience, it's thumb in your nose at the government, maybe. Maybe that's what it's really all about, but I don't see it as being of any practical significance.
Comment, Paul?
I was just going to say, I think the significant thing is how this is going to change in the future. I mean, if you get to the stage right now, as I understand it, a lot of these plastic guns aren't as durable. They're not as reliable. They might be only good for one or two uses. Then they might explode or overheat or whatever. That you still need a metal firing pin or need some other metal attached to it to make them more effective. I don't know why anyone would do it. I used to give a speech. And actually, I think it's kind of interesting. It's trying to understand, all guns, ignoring the 3D guns, basically all guns start out in the legal market. How do they end up in the hands of the bad guys? And it's something I think we should study. I mean, oftentimes they're stolen from the good guy with the gun who buys it for his defensive gun use. He leaves it in his cars, gets stolen, leaves it in his home, gets stolen, this sort of thing. And I'd point out that you don't really have gangs in the basements in Chicago making guns. Well, now theoretically you can have gangs making the guns and, that might change the mix, but I that's still years away, I think. But, if it ever gets to the stage where you could easily make an effective multi-use gun on your own, I think it's going to make it the debate's going to be a lot different.
Next question.
Hi, this question's for Paul. Since you mentioned mass shootings, it seems to be the case that a lot of these shootings might have been prevented if already existing laws were properly and effectively enforced. I'm curious as to why you're advocating for additional regulations and restrictions if it's the case that the already existing laws might have already prevented these laws if they were properly enforced. So.
I'm not sure what laws you're talking about other than laws against murder. Yeah, it's against the law to murder somebody. But it's laws serve a number of purposes. You know, laws hopefully are written to try to prevent crimes, bad things from occurring. Laws are also written when a bad thing occurs, then you've got a legal right to arrest that person and charge them for it. Laws also sort of set what communities, what society's norms are for behavior. A lot of the mass shootings, though, basically the person didn't break any law at all. The Gabby Giffords shooter, Arizona basically has no laws on the books or with regard to guns. He wasn't breaking a single law, carrying the gun, carrying a loaded gun, waving the loaded gun. He didn't break the law till he pulled the trigger the first time. And again, he wasn't stopped by the good guy with the gun around the corner. He was stopped when the magazine ran out of the bullets and he got tackled by some 65-year-old type person. So the Sandy Hook shooter.
The old people.
Yeah. The Sandy Hook shooter, his mother had a good collection of guns that didn't do her any good. He used one of them to shoot her, and then he goes to the school to shoot people. And again, you had some of the school kids get away when he went to change the magazine out because the magazine only held 31 bullets. You know, if he'd had a smaller magazine that was capped at 10 or 15 or 18, more people might have gotten away too. I mean, when laws have problems, then you strengthen the laws. Just one real quick example. One of the few gun control laws we have on the books is the Gun Control Act of 1968. It set the list of prohibited purchasers, felons, people who are dangerously mentally ill. For 25 years, basically, the way it operated is they'd say, if I wanted to buy a gun, they'd say, Paul, are you a felon? I'd say, no. They'd say, here's your gun. I mean, I'd have to fill out the rest of the form. But they just relied on my say-so. Obviously, bad people can lie. So the Brady Bill that started to have background checks from federally licensed dealers said, let's do a check on this sort of thing. We didn't say, gee, that prohibited purchaser law doesn't work. Let's get rid of it. We said, let's figure out what we need to do by going to the federally licensed gun dealers who presumably are law abiding to figure out what they can do. When we have something that's not working and bad things happen, look to see if you need to change the law, strengthen the law, get rid of the law and have to try something else. But instead, we just basically say, laws are no good. We can't do anything. Woe is us. Let's get more guns. And, you know, like I always say, if more guns made us safer, we'd be the safest country in the world. And we're not.
Comment? Go ahead.
Yeah, the one specific gun control measure that Paul mentions that the Brady campaign and other gun control organizations mentioned is a ban on large capacity magazines. The idea being that if these mass shooters had magazines that held no more than 10 rounds, which is the usual cutoff for these bans, then they'd hurt fewer people. So the argument, it's a subtle one, but it's, well, there's no real difference between a guy who has 30 rounds in three separate magazines, each holding 10 rounds, versus a guy who has a single 30-round magazine. It's not the difference in rounds that matters. It's the fact that the guy who has only 10-round magazines, he has to reload more often. So that's why Paul keeps citing that one example of Gabriel Giffords. Somebody tackled the shooter while he was reloading. The problem is, A, we don't really know that's what happened. He may well have been struggling with a defective magazine, and that's why they were able to tackle him. In other words, it had nothing to do with him trying to reload, as far as we know. Maybe that was the case, but there is, to my knowledge, in the past 30 years, not a single case of somebody who actually got tackled while they were reloading. So the fact that a ban on big magazines would make the shooter reload more often, it doesn't have the significance he's hinting. And he also says that in the Sandy Hook shooting, a bunch of school kids escaped while the guy was reloading. We, in fact, haven't the slightest evidence that's what was happening. We don't know whether he was just choosing to stop shooting for a while, whether he was taking a break to, you know, wipe the perspiration off his forehead. We have no idea. There's no evidence whatsoever that his reloading efforts had absolutely anything to do with those kids escaping.
Next question.
Thank you. Paul, you mentioned that a lot of the school shootings as an example, like Sandy Hook, and you said, you know, we didn't have a good guy with a gun stopping the shootings. You also earlier compared U.S. statistics to, and I quote, other civilized countries. So my question is, would you then support a law that would actually repeal the law that didn't allow a good guy with a gun to stop the shootings because of the guaranteed victim or the Gun-Free School Zones Act, which is why we couldn't have a good guy with a gun stopping shootings? And could you also define what a civilized country is, since you compare the United States to other civilized countries?
And I meant developed countries, and I tried to clarify that when I was speaking. And it's generally they look at 25 and other industrialized countries when they're doing these comparisons. The other comparison was to like Canada, New Zealand, and Australia, because they had sort of the frontier settlement background that we had. I have no objection to schools hiring school resource officers, bringing in police officers to deal with the when there's a threat, to deal with the possibility of a threat, to deal with the school shootings. I'm opposed to having teachers given the responsibility of doing this. My wife was a teacher for 37 years. It was tough enough to keep your purse secure, much less a gun secure in the classroom. I've talked to people that have been shot and injured at Virginia Tech and in other school shooting situations. And some of these people are people that were familiar with guns, had used guns, new guns, and they've indicated that the gun would have done nothing for them, would have only made them an earlier target in situations. It's, if we're going to have, if there's a threat someplace, get someone who's trained to handle that threat to that place to deal with it. That's how you handle these situations. There's, you're never going to have a perfect situation. Again, we're always hoping that the hero's there someplace, but in real life, that's hard to have. Adding more guns to the situation just ends up usually having more things go wrong. Has anyone here been in a school when there's been a school shooting?
I guess not.
Okay.
The gentleman in the back at the bar.
The one I usually bring up, like when I'm speaking to college campuses, because a lot of times they'll talk about, college kids should be able to have their concealed carry permit. And I talk about, the folks have gone to years of school generally and have not many people have ever been in the school shooting, and there's more now than there used to be. Then I say, how many of you in college knew anyone who ever got drunk? How many of you in college knew anyone that abused drugs? How many in college knew anyone who was seriously depressed or had relationship issues, whatever? And then you add into that the fact that college dorms are not very secure and that classrooms don't have places to store things. The idea of adding more guns into a college setting or even a K through 12 setting, I don't think makes sense unless you're hiring professionals to be there.
Comment, Kay? Yeah.
Yeah, Paul argues that the reason why you can't have authorized teachers or security officers with guns in a school is because you can't secure the gun. If you can't secure a purse, how can you secure a gun? There's a simple device called a trigger lock, which is, it just goes behind the trigger and it makes it utterly impossible to fire the gun, whether you're a kid in a classroom or anybody else. If you're not the authorized user who doesn't have a key to stick in that lock, you're not going to be able to use it. To my knowledge, in 40 years of research, I've never heard of a single documented case where somebody defeated a trigger lock and then did harm with the gun, where an unauthorized user got a hold of the gun and disengaged the trigger lock. That is, they didn't commit homicides, they didn't commit suicides, and they didn't commit an accidental death or injury with the gun. So that's not an issue. But the fact that people have to make up these spurious reasons why you couldn't have an authorized shooter just shows the weaknesses of the argument. It's not like every school teacher would be packing a gun in their hip. The usual proposal is there was one or two people who have been trained, often because they're former military or police, who are the authorized accessors of the gun. And there may be one or two guns in the entire school, and they're secured with either a lock cabinet or a trigger lock. And so the idea that, well, the problem is somebody unauthorized will get a hold of the gun and God knows what will happen, it's not an issue. I mean, if you want to argue, well, then they'd be surprised or shocked and they wouldn't have the frame of mind to use the gun effectively. That's possible. That's a plausible argument. But the idea that you couldn't secure the gun, or these proposals entail all the teachers being armed and packing a gun on their hip, that's crazy. That has nothing to do with the real debate.
Next question.
Thank you, guys. My question is to the both of you. Seems as both of you are okay with background checks, and you happen to make a quip about gangs in Chicago printing guns. So I guess that's a little allusion to the black communities in Chicago that are experiencing gun violence by gangs. So my question, I'm going to frame this question under New York State gun control laws. So in New York State, you have to put up $700 registration fee to get a permit. You need seven pieces of ID outside of your municipal ID to get a permit. And apparently, asking for ID for voting is racist. So imagine seven pieces of ID. You can get denied for your gun permit if you were convicted of a single felony in your previous life. I mean, in your previous before, you know, applying for that permit, and you could still get denied. So it seems to me that these sort of laws, really, these gun control laws in New York really only affect communities of color, because most legal gun owners in New York are white. So I would like to know, would either of you guys be in support of repealing New York's racist gun laws?
Thank you for the question. This will have to be the last question. Why don't you, Gary, go first with that question, and then Paul, and then we'll have a summation. Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, it doesn't apply just to racial minorities. It applies to everybody. It's almost impossible for a middle-class white person to get a permit in the city of New York. And it's the city more than the rest of the state of New York. And the questioner did accurately portray just how very difficult it is. Furthermore, it can be denied on totally subjective grounds. Somebody in the police department can say, I don't think this person has a reasonable basis or sufficient reasonable basis to get a permit. And there's no specific criteria that are articulated in the law. It can be a completely arbitrary subjective judgment. And yes, when you have that kind of discretion, anybody who happens to be personally racially biased, or for that matter gender biased, can easily let those biases influence that subjective a judgment, which is quite different from the standard background check, where it's cut and dried. You either have a criminal conviction or you don't. If you do, you can't get the gun, the permit, whatever. And if you're clean, then you can go ahead and get it. But New York City's laws are remarkably subjective.
Comment, Paul?
And just first of all, anyone who has a felony, regardless of how long ago it is banned. It cannot buy a gun, much less get a permit to carry. That's federal law. So that's one of the things that goes back to the Gun Control Act of 1968. The Supreme Court has not yet ruled on the issue of whether there's a constitutional right to carry a gun outside of your house. Both the Heller case and the McDonald case said you had a right to have a gun in your home for self-defense. So we're not really getting into the constitutional issues. I've generally, and I don't know the details of New York's carry laws, I generally support may issue states rather than shall issue states, where the sheriff or the police chief can have a chance to deny someone, because oftentimes they're going to have information that might not be a formal disqualifier for buying a gun, but they'll know that they've responded to 25 domestic arguments at that place, or they've got neighbors that know that say drugs are being sold there, or they have arrested this person five or six times, but don't have it might be on a misdemeanor charge that involves violence, but not enough to make them bar them for carrying. I do think that the way to counteract subjective discrimination would be to have some sort of an appeal process for those things, and that doesn't bother me. But generally, I trust the sheriffs and the police chiefs to have a better sense of who should be able to carry loaded guns in public and therefore endanger the rest of us. And I think that's a good way to go.
Thank you, Paul. Summations. You have 5 minutes to summarize. You can take the podium, or you can do it from the chair. Prefer to do it from the chair. Go ahead.
I'm still lazy. Okay. Still going to do it from the chair. Um, You know, the debate is the really technical debate is too boring to talk about. But, you know, in a way, this issue really boils down to how much defensive gun use there is. And it's a mark of how threatening large numbers of defensive gun uses is to the pro-control movement that they go to such great lengths to discredit large estimates. Paul seriously suggests that you can count up defensive gun uses by counting up how many news articles there are about them. He doesn't actually quite say, I believe that. In fact, he kind of hints he doesn't believe it, but why bring it up? He offers the National Crime Victimization Survey's estimate of 100,000 defensive gun uses, but that survey has never asked a single respondent a direct question about defensive gun use. They're only counting up how many people kind of volunteer the information that they pointed a deadly weapon at another human being. And not surprisingly, in a government-run, government-sponsored survey, which is not anonymous, where they know where you live and your telephone number and name and so on, people are not really inclined to volunteer that information. That survey has nothing to say in this debate. But there are 20 national surveys, plus, 20 plus, that have without exception indicated defensive gun use is really common. And why is this surprising? Millions of Americans, tens of millions of Americans, maybe hundreds of thousands of Americans own guns. And there's a lot of crime out there where you'd have an opportunity and a need to use a gun for self-protection. So this is a fact that needs to be taken account of in making policy. You shouldn't be making policy that cuts into people using guns for self-protective purposes, where they're not killing people to protect themselves. They're just avoiding death and injury themselves, for the most part, by pointing a gun at a criminal and saying, knock it off. And so I don't have any problem at all with gun control measures that are selectively aimed at bad guys, including convicted felons, and including people who have been declared to be dangerous to themselves and others by a court of law. I have no problem with that either. But what I do have a problem with is laws that'll disarm more people, whether it be of all guns or handguns or so-called assault weapons or large capacity magazines. It'll do this more for non-criminals than for criminals. All of that is bad policy, poorly thought out, and not supported by the best available evidence.
So let's put together some good policy that's going to try to reduce the number of deaths, the number of injuries and costs of having guns, but still not take the guns away that are going to be used for defensive gun purposes. Gary concedes that background checks make sense. We've discussed so-called assault weapons. There's no evidence, I don't think, at least in the early thing I read, maybe it's because it was written in the mid-90s, that the so-called assault weapons were used for defensive purposes. I mean, most of the time, the person was, first of all, waving a handgun. I think that was the most prevalent that you had. I don't have the chart in front of me now. On your chart, you do. In your survey, you indicate if you responded to the offender, 48% of whom didn't have a gun, with a gun, what kind of weapon did you have? And they list baseball bats, knives, handguns. They don't list a assault rifles. That's a, you know, so what I'm saying is that we can form, you know, we can structure some things. Registration and licensing, if we go there, shouldn't be taking the guns away from good people. It should be helping us track who actually owns the gun and where it's going. Laws on reporting lost and stolen guns wouldn't do something. Laws requiring guns to be locked up, like Gary suggests for schools, might make some sense. There are things we can do. But what we're doing is nothing. We're allowing people to basically buy any kind of gun, any number of these guns as they can, and then we end up with the cost of it. And a lot of times I think what we haven't talked about tonight either is how these defensive gun uses sometimes in and of themselves cause problems. I think in one of Gary's columns, he talks about maybe 33% are bad guy versus bad guy defensive gun uses. You get sometimes where basically you get an arms race or an escalation of the conflict because of the gun. I mean, look at the George Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin situation. You know, here's something that should have at the worst been a fight, and George Zimmerman pulls out the gun and Trayvon Martin's dead. You get the situation the other day, somebody comes to their house and the door's open. So they pull their gun and they shoot. And it turns out it's a Dallas police officer and she's in the wrong room. You know, these are what people consider defensive gun uses. Having that gun makes someone more willing to pull the gun, more willing to shoot the gun, more willing to escalate situations that shouldn't be. Again, I concede, I admit, I agree. There are good purposes used for guns. I'm not anti-gun. But I think we need to realize that when we as a society allow people to have an instrument that can kill others, kill many others, kill them at a distance, and particularly when we allow people to carry those loaded in public, thereby impacting others either accidentally or intentionally or negligently or recklessly, then we as a society, I think, have an appropriate chance to respond to that. It's not a constitutional issue. It's one that requires some research. It requires some good policy. My bottom line tonight is, let's not take away good defensive gun uses. Let's try to get some more effective gun laws that will make it harder for dangerous people to get guns. Let's lift the prohibitions on studying these issues and treat this as a public health issue and try to make it safer for all of us. Instead, everybody goes to their corner, I'm all for guns or I'm all against guns. I don't know anyone who wants to ban all guns. I don't know anyone who wants everyone to have every gun there is. There should be plenty of room for middle ground here. Let's decide which people should be restricted. Right now, we restrict felons, dangerously mentally ill, and some others. Let's see if some violent misdemeanors should be put in that category, and maybe some tax cheat felons should be taken off of that category. You know, you can look at who gets guns. Let's look at the types of guns. Right now, we restrict machine guns, fully automatic. We've done that since the mid-1930s. Been effective. You don't see machine guns used in bank robberies anymore. Let's decide if semi-automatics ought to be treated more like machine guns or create new rules for them. You know, let's go through those categories. Where should guns be excluded? Who should be able to carry a gun? What kind of guns should be out there? Those are the sorts of things that the Supreme Court says are constitutionally permissible. Those are things that could be effective. Those are things that should be studied. This shouldn't be the hot button issue that we make it out to. Gary and I shouldn't have to come back 10 years from now having the same argument that we had 10 years ago. Thank you for being here.
Okay. Brett, you ready to bring the results?
Yeah.
Okay. Please bring them up. All right. The initial vote in favor of the resolution was 45.59%. That rose to 50%. So the yes votes picked up 6.41%. That's the number to beat. The no votes were 33.33 and declined slightly to 33.77, down 2.56%. It looks like the yes gets the Tootsie Roll. Congratulations, Gary. Yeah.